The Spinoff Podcast Network. Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
Tēnā koutou katoa, no mai, haere mai ki Dietary Requirements, the Spinoff's food podcast, ko Simon Day toko ingoa, kei te hiakai ahau. In exciting news, the band is back together. The three co-hosts are all here in the same room. I have the Spinoff's food editor, Alice Neville. Kia ora, Alice.
Kia ora, Simon.
And after a three-month food holiday, Sophie Gilmore is back. Welcome home, Soph.
Thanks very much.
And happy birthday.
Thanks.
Happy birthday for yesterday.
I had an awesome birthday, so thank you.
It sounded like you had an awesome holiday, and in harnessing that, we're going to explore one of the countries Sophie visited today. Look at the cuisine of the US, you know, the rise of fast food culture being hip culture. Have a look at fried chicken. We're going to drink some American pale ale and some Californian Chardonnay. And we wouldn't be here eating and drinking those things without our wonderful food sponsors. And Dietary Requirements is brought to you by Freedom Farms and Fine Wine Delivery Company. Freedom Farms believes that everyone who eats meat has a responsibility to know how that animal has been farmed, and they're dedicated to providing you with the best pork, free-range chicken, and eggs. This week we're eating some of their chicken thighs, which I deep-fried last night and are currently being reheated by the in-house fried chicken aficionado Madeline Chapman. And you can check out all their products at freedomfarms.co.nz. And the Fine Wine Delivery Company is all about bringing you the best wine, beer, and spirits at the best price. If you're in Auckland, their buzzy superstores are on Lunn Ave in Mount Wellington and Constellation Drive, giant purple warehouses of joy. But you can also get everything you need from their website, finewinedelivery.co.nz. The first thing I thought we'd do, Sophie, is find out exactly where you went, get a maybe chronological rundown from a food perspective of the 3 months you were away.
I was actually thinking it's funny you called it a food holiday because that's exactly what it is. Some people call it a normal holiday, but I like to make sure that I am particular about all the places that I eat, and obviously cooking school comes into that category as well. I left Auckland on the 7th of July and just got back now. So you might say my life has been a big food party since then. And then I went to Mexico first up.
What does real Mexican food taste like? What does it look like?
It's really interesting to separate authentic Mexican food from what we've come to know it as. It was pretty difficult for us at times to track down salad and freshness. Like, Mexican people just love delicious meat in a delicious tortilla, and if you're lucky you might get a little shaving of pineapple on top. But we went to one place in the whole of Mexico when we were in Puerto Escondido, and this hilarious Mexican kind of ex-gangster dude in his illegal back garden made us these tacos on plastic plates while he was ranting about how he hates his staff and they didn't show up and he was hungover. in like 40 degree heat. He made these piles of tacos that were probably the best thing we ate the whole time we were there. So that was prawns that had been deep fried with a coconut batter on them, sitting on top of really crunchy lettuce and covered in salsa.
Yeah.
But other than that, most of the things that we had in Mexico were pretty purist, like one or two ingredients. And that's the biggest difference. Like when we got to America, we were in Texas, and so I specifically requested our host take us to a Tex-Mex restaurant, having just come from Mexico, and the food couldn't be more different.
So after Mexico, across the border into the US?
Yeah, we went right through Mexico. So after Puerto Escondido, we went up to Oaxaca, which is the food capital of Mexico and is getting a lot of airtime in food media at the moment. Unfortunately, that coincided with me getting food poisoning for the first time in my life.
Oh, no.
Well, I don't think it was food poisoning. I think it was brushing my teeth with the water, which I was told in no uncertain terms not to do. But having never
You're a rebel.
Having never had any sort of bug in my life, I was being a bit arrogant and got taught a lesson in Oaxaca. Mm. So the food in Oaxaca is where you get all the moles, so really complex sauces with basically just served with rice and meat, which was really cool to go to a food market and taste them all up against each other. And they have specific rules around what colour mole you can have with what meat and at what time. So that was cool. And Oaxaca's kind of famous for its hot chocolate, which for me was not particularly enjoyable because it's loaded with sugar.
Oh,
so
right.
It's like a block of, they heat it with hot, like you can do milk or water, or you can order half-half. And it's like a block of chocolate that's about half chocolate, half sugar. So that was Oaxaca. Sorry, I'm getting through it. Then we went to Mexico City, and the highlight was we went to Puyo, which is the recipe from the Chef's Table episode with the mole madre, which people might have watched. And that was awesome. We did the degustation there that was the one you sit up at the bar and you do eight courses of tacos.
Ooh.
The other more sort of stiff version is to sit in a restaurant and do the fine dining full 3-hour situation. So we were really stoked with what we did. We had matching drinks and mezcal and a great time.
Did you have any of that corn fungus stuff?
No, that wasn't served to us, but we did have the one of the tacos that we had the mole madre, which was, I think at this time, 1,300 days old. Do you remember on the Chef's Table episode he goes through how many days it's been?
Oh,
so
right.
Basically, like a sourdough starter, they use a little bit of yesterday's mole to make today's one.
Yeah.
And there's one that's been going. He's got a tally on it.
Awesome.
And it was on the episode. So that was a great time.
Nice.
Then I went to the States and flew into Texas, and another, and kind of relevant to today's episode, hipster food destination. Everyone is doing everything in this like cool hipster alternative way, but the food was epic. Like they're doing it really well. So like a huge slice of pizza as big as your face, but it tastes amazing.
So Texas is a very big place. Where were the standout destinations for that vibe?
Austin. Yeah, so Austin appealed to me. It's kind of affectionately called the blueberry and the tomato soup. And I'm unashamedly a fan of the old country tunes. So this was working well for me because the snacks were there too. Texas was amazing. We stayed south of Congress, so they're calling it SoCo, this area. And everything that we had was absolutely delicious. We even lined up for Franklin Barbecue, which I wasn't sure was worth the wait. And I'd read a whole lot of stuff, and everyone that had been said, it's going to be worth the wait. So we lined up, and it was absolutely epic.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Then we went to Houston and that's where I had the Tex-Mex.
You would have felt at home in Houston as the Beyonce of the New Zealand food scene.
True.
I can actually tell you that I did not feel home at home in Houston.
Oh.
It felt really interesting to me to be surrounded by a whole lot of, I think the majority of the population there have quite a different ideology to me, and I could almost feel it. It was really interesting. And then so we carried on our road trip and got to New Orleans.
Ooh.
And the food in New Orleans was. I used Leisha Jones's article that she wrote for Stone Soup.
Yeah, that made
as a bit of an itinerary.
Yeah.
And then added a few other recommendations to it. And it was, we've had an absolute shocker going for 2 days. You need to go back, go for 7 days, go for the music. And I went to the best Middle Eastern restaurant in my life on Magazine Street in New Orleans. Awesome. Who would have thought?
Did you have any crawfish?
Yes, we had. We actually ate all of the different things that are really well known.
Gumbo.
And then we, the fried chicken and slaw.
Oh, yeah.
We had, po' boys. We pulled over on our way. We did a road trip, so we pulled over off the freeway and went to a famous po' boy shop, which was unreal.
Nice.
And then there was Italian restaurants in the hotel that we were staying in. There was an Italian restaurant. The Middle Eastern one was called Shire and was amazing. And then a super hipster cafe called The Turkey and the Wolf, which is an exact example of the other things we're going to be talking about today.
Did you know you can hire your own second line brass band in New Orleans and have a parade down the streets?
Perfect.
Just for yourself?
What, as a tourist activity?
You know, friends are doing it for their wedding.
Okay. So oh, yeah, that's cool.
They've picked out New Orleans for both the food and the culture as a place where they want to go and celebrate their union, and they've hired a second line band to host them down the street.
A cool place. Like, the music is on French Street. We had second line. We had all of the different types of music. Amazing brass. Like, just in a line, just place to place. And you can just have a drink and stay if you like it, or go to the next place and see what the music's like there. It's literally a whole lot of varieties of country and blues and everything, and jazz.
Anika Moore just recorded her new album in New Orleans.
Did she?
And they made a little film about it, which I saw at an event launching her album recently where I went with some spin-off people. You didn't come, Simon, but it was good. Made me want to go to New Orleans.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the note of what Simon said before, having gone from Texas where I felt like part of the vibe to Houston where I felt a bit other, and then going into New Orleans, it almost felt like going home. I was so grateful for the
nice
people and the culture and the food, and yeah, it was a real experience going there.
What's that, Simon?
This is the Billfish American Pale Ale.
Yep.
But I reckon we get to that once we get to America.
Okay.
Or to the discussion itself.
Good plan.
After New Orleans?
It's absolutely delicious, Simon.
Very refreshing.
Very drinkable.
For a hot studio.
Mm. After New Orleans, we went to LA, Bay Bay. And look, I love the restaurants in LA a lot. And I dragged my husband on what he might say was the worst day, but was the best day for me, at Venice Beach to 6 different restaurants on one day.
Wow, that's good effort.
Yeah, so just like a snack and a little beverage in each one. But we went to one for oysters. We finished at Delina, which is my favourite one. We went to Wabi Sabi for sushi. We went to The Rose for salad. Just made our way along Abbot Kinney pretty much. But
sounds like the dream.
Yeah, and we also went to Osteria Mozza
in
West Hollywood. For it was our 10-year anniversary, so it was a bit of a special occasion, and we loved it. It was awesome.
Nice.
Nancy Silverton's also in one of the episodes of Chef's Table.
Nancy Silverton is my food hero. She's just so incredible.
She's also the hero of Andrew, who owns Wild Wheat in Auckland, the sourdough master.
Yeah.
She's kind of like his inspiration. And
there's that incredible quote in that episode where someone's trying to describe what Nancy isn't. You know, he's like, she doesn't care about emulsions and liquid nitrogen and microgreens and 12-course degustations. And the person interviewing this guy goes, what does Nancy care about? And he thinks is salads, pizza, and pasta.
Yeah.
And it's just
nice.
So,
my home girl.
Yeah, that is just so exactly all you need in food, really.
Yeah.
I think she's amazing. And I think that a lot of the specialty restaurants in America are doing such a great job of being epic at what they do and not trying to be all things to all people.
Yeah.
Because being away, you see that tourist restaurants literally like just serve spaghetti bolognese and you're like in the middle of Greece. Like, what is going on?
Yeah.
You know? So that was really cool. And to wrap up, after we went to LA, Oh, which also, if anyone goes to LA soon, I think that Squirrel was quite an amazing experience for breakfast.
The Squirrel?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it's, I don't know how to pronounce it because it's S-Q-U-I-R-L.
Oh, yeah, I've squirrel. Heard of that. Squirrel.
Yeah.
I thought it was Squirrel, but I don't actually know.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not sure either. That. But that was a good time for a hipster breakfast. But she's kind of gone down the Whole Foods lane without disregarding flavor. So I had this like really buzzy popped rice thing that kind of tasted like salt and vinegar chips with pork sausage through it and an egg on top of it.
Nice.
Yeah, it was an absolute hell of a time.
Yum.
So from there, I went to Ireland to cooking school, and everyone's already heard about that on my diary.
Yes, I'm sure you've all been reading. The number five's about to go up for week five. So number five.
Yeah, and
I think leave make listeners go and read about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Check out the diaries from...
Yeah, check them out. Recipes too.
Do you have a good Irish accent now, though? Can you do a good...
Oh, to be sure. I absolutely loved Ireland and the food there. And on the way home after Ireland, I went to Portugal with my mother.
You've been bloody everywhere.
I went to Greece to join some friends on their honeymoon.
I saw that. Oh,
just
nice.
Turned that into a buddy moon. And then...
Yeah, talk about third wheel.
Yeah, big time. Amsterdam, London and home. And the last thing that I think that I should mention is that the River Cafe was potentially the best restaurant experience of my life.
Nice.
Why?
It was just perfect.
Yeah.
I could go on for days, but that's really all I need to say. It was unbelievable.
We'll make you write something.
Yeah, good idea.
Go there.
Okay.
But so Sophie's journey inspired us to choose one of the places she spent a significant amount of time and look into its food culture a little bit. And I think it's really interesting how we've seen the rise of in inverted commas, American cuisine, because one, it's so hard to define and it's so very broad, but this development of a scene around fast food becoming quality food, fast food becoming cool food, and fast food also becoming really, really good food as well. Sophie's sister actually is Mimi Gilmore, who... started Burger Burger and was probably the first in New Zealand to make the burger experience a dining out experience, somewhere you would go on a date, somewhere you'd go, you know, for a longer time than just smashing out a burger. What do you think American food is, and why has it caught on as a trend in the way it has?
I'm quite interested in this, and also I like to, as I go through places, go quite deep on Wikipedia. So I know the full family history and background of all of the massive burger chains in America.
Interesting.
And quite often they come out of one good idea that then got taken on by someone with a bit of business nous, and often they get ruined along the way. I think that the American hamburger is probably as iconic as it gets. But there are a whole lot of American foods that we don't actually have a lot of in New Zealand that seem to be on all their menus over there. And I think we're going to talk about hot chicken today. But, for example, chicken wings doused in extremely hot sauce is not something that we have regularly here. And I learned to enjoy why they dip chicken wings into blue cheese sauce, which I previously thought was quite rank. So.
I still think it's rank.
No,
it's enlighten me.
Okay, so I think you'd be fine dipping a piece of fried chicken into some mayonnaise.
Yes.
What they do is they don't, the blue cheese sauce is not, it's not Stilton flavored. It's a small amount of cheese that counteracts all the stuff that they put in the crumb on the chicken. So when it's all together and you have the whole lot going on in your mouth, it's brilliant.
Intriguing.
I'll try again. Maybe the blue cheese sauce.
You don't look convinced,
Simon. Maybe the blue cheese sauce in New Zealand is too strong.
Yeah.
I feel like it robs you of your chicken.
Yeah, it should be more mayonnaise, less cheese, but I really enjoyed the actual flavor of it once I got into it. It's been exhausting, guys.
God, yeah.
And You talked to me before we got into the studio about how good American food is fantastic, but it can be really, really hard to find.
Mm.
Surrounded by shit most places.
Yeah, so we did a road trip from Austin through to New Orleans, and we decided to stop at every fast food place along the way and give it a taste. And this is probably David's favorite part of the trip. Yeah. But for example, we stopped at Whataburger, which is almost like a really terrible version of In-N-Out. And I didn't really understand what it was that was making people go there. We ordered a burger. We tasted it. The bread was soggy. The patty could not really have been worse. We got some onion rings thinking maybe that was the secret deliciousness. That was also pretty disgusting. Overall, just completely underwhelming. And then you compare that to when you go to In-N-Out in LA, for example, and you get like a whole raw onion round in your burger. If you're into that, you can get them cooked. But it's fresh and it's crisp, and they cook the patty properly, and they're making the chips with the potato machine in front of you, and it just makes such an enormous difference. So I think that good American food relies, is us imposing what our view of it is. But my overall thing is that if the food's cooked well, it's pretty delicious. If the food's not cooked well, it's not.
True that.
There's a real nostalgia to that famous American food that I think I have in my mind. You know, I always begged to go to McDonald's when I was a young boy, and now we get a better version of it, but the same sort of memories when you go to places like Burger Burger.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you go to Lowbrow. Big shout out to Lowbrow. I went there last week and it's fantastic.
Like, yeah.
It's doing simple, nostalgic food really, really, really well.
And I think it's kind of more on, it suits our taste more now. Like one of the things I think that they sell the most of at Burger Burger, for example, is the broccoli side dish. It really pisses me off when I go somewhere and everything is fried, because I just,
yeah, totally.
I don't want to eat food that makes me feel disgusting, even if it tastes good.
Yeah.
So I need something to counteract all of the fat, and it needs to be something acidic or salty or fresh. And so the ones that are doing it really well, I think, are more suited to the modern palate.
Yeah, definitely. And that, yeah, it just comes back to knowing what you're doing in the kitchen, I think, and good ingredients.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone has the right to turn their nose up at anyone else's cuisine.
Yeah.
But I do think that you can comment on the ability of, or the effort that's gone into the way that the food is prepared, because it makes an enormous difference,
yeah,
when things are treated with respect and cooked well, or like thoughtfully, mm, compared to when they're not.
True.
Did you see a lot of overweight people in the US?
It's not coming to mind in any sort of massive way. Like the places that we went, like Austin's full of massive hipsters, and they just look like international hipsters. They're, yeah, everywhere.
So underfed rather than overfed.
Yeah. Miserable and anxious. No, they've got like man buns and beards and like.
Sounds right up my alley.
And some of them. Don't give a shit and just let it all hang out and play jazz music. And no, it wasn't particularly different to anywhere else. The Cajun and the Creole people in New Orleans are super thin. No, on reflection. I was the most overweight person on my trip.
I remember going to Disneyland when I was like 12 and just being like, whoa.
Yeah.
A lot of like really obese people. But yeah, maybe New Zealand now, because we have quite an obesity problem,
yeah,
it's probably caught up, so it's not so.
Yeah, it wasn't dramatic, and I had the same feeling. I remember going to Disneyland as a child and having that same, yeah, oh my gosh,
maybe
moment.
It's just Disneyland.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people getting shimmied through airports in wheelchairs these days.
Yeah.
And it's because of how far you have to walk, and
yeah,
a lot of health-associated problems with that. But no, I don't actually, yeah. In LA also, we did the like touristy hike up Runyon Canyon, and yeah, everyone was just looking fit and healthy, but they have
you were hiking up a canyon, though.
Yeah, but they call it hiking. It's really just walking, isn't it? Like, we just put on shoes and go for a walk.
Yeah.
They call that hiking.
Hiking.
Another really popular aspect of American cuisine that we've seen take off in a big way, and again in a very sort of it's entered highbrow food, is fried chicken.
Yes.
And we have an expert at the spin-off on fried chicken, Madeline Chapman, who I'm going to call. And, hi, Mad.
Hey, I'm outside with your chicken and it almost burned.
It's almost burned.
No, it's almost burned.
Oh, well done. You got it out in time. Come in.
So, all right, I'll be there in a sec.
Come on in with the fried chicken.
Mad's going to join us as a special guest to talk about the culture of fried chicken.
Because she wrote one of the funniest and best articles I've read lately on the subject.
She did.
Taking Simon Wilson to KFC is an impressive feat.
I've tried to get her to like really own this fried chicken round though, and she's kind of fought back a bit. She's been like, no, I'm not just about fried chicken. I don't want the fried chicken round.
Yeah. But yeah, look, I mean, no one likes to be pigeonholed, Alice.
Exactly. Or chicken.
Oh, hole. Here's the chicken. Hello, fried chicken.
Just look a little bit on the dark side. Hill Henry's fault.
I think you've done Freedom Farms well. I think they look great.
I'm really proud of this, actually. I'll put the recipe on the website.
Yeah.
It's recommended by Henry Mad. Would you like a beer?
Yes, please.
Could you please run us through the chicken recipe that you've used, Simon? It looks very crispy.
So I ran out of time to get buttermilk, and I don't actually know what buttermilk is, so I melted butter into milk.
Oh my god, no, you didn't.
That's not what it is.
It's soured milk.
Doesn't matter.
You buy it in a carton.
But you can't have too much butter on anything. So I melted some butter into milk.
Oh my god, that's amazing. I love it. You can't really go wrong with butter and anything.
No,
some
true.
Eggs and some sugar and some salt and pepper into the milk, and then let the chicken sit in that for kind of brine in there in my buttermilk for ages, and then
marinating in a pool of buttery milk.
Then delicious. I used the recipe that Henry Oliver recommended, just a whole lot of spices, paprika, cayenne pepper, garlic powder, heaps
of
herbs.
It's quite bougie fried chicken.
It's
all happening.
It's on brand. but I think we should have a taste because I'm proud of it.
I'm 100% keen.
Fingers on, I reckon.
Is it?
Yeah.
Take one and pass it on. Yeah.
I don't even eat chicken.
Creative direction.
Thank you. Brilliant.
I'll pretend.
Get the crunch on.
Yeah, should we try? I was going to say, should we try and bite it next to the microphone?
Just for Catherine McGregor's benefit, crunch but no chew.
Okay.
She doesn't like chewing on the pot.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Yum.
I'm going to eat it.
It was crunchier last night, fresh out of the fryer, but that's still...
Yeah, you get that.
It's still pretty good. And recommendation from Hillary at Freedom Farms is to try to use skin-on chicken.
That's a good shout.
No, I've got chicken skin in my teeth.
Does that just keep all the batter on?
And it also, deep fried fat is delicious, you know? How does that go for you, Matt?
Good.
Out of 10?
Be honest. Not,
am I?
Yeah, on? You're on. I can hear you.
Very good, actually. I like there's a little bit of spice. I don't know what it is. But
is it cayenne?
I appreciate that.
Moist, isn't it?
Yeah, surprisingly, since I definitely left it in the little oven thing out there for too long.
It's so maintained.
The benefit of thigh, underrated piece of the
benefit of thigh,
piece of the chicken.
Is that the name of your next novel?
Oh,
why are thighs next underrated?
No, I think people gravitate to breasts far too often.
It's the name of your first novel.
We used to at Bird on a Wire have people come in, you know, can I have a thigh piece? More of a breast man myself.
how what would you do to your chicken, your fried chicken at Bird on a Wire, Sophie?
So, We did two different fried chickens. When we launched it, we agonized over the best way to serve it, and we decided we wanted to do what KFC did, in the sense that we wanted to keep the bone in the pieces of chicken and then make them the best that we could. So in Bourdon Wire style, we had a massive fried chicken off at my house. Everybody had to come and bring, I think we had three different pieces of chicken to cook each. Each person had to, they had to execute their favourite method. So we had lots of it in buttermilk. We had dusted and floured. We had all sorts. Anyway, the result that we ended up with, and we had a party and launched it in our Takapuna courtyard.
Oh, I think I remember that.
The DJ, and we were drinking whiskey and stuff. It was confit, so we cooked it in its own fat, and then we floured it, and then we fried it.
And you just beat me up for being bougie.
And I thought it was absolutely awesome. Anyway, turns out the New Zealand public preferred chicken without bones in it from Bourdon Wire, and it just didn't seem like that approachable, because I think people want it as a, you know, something to share or like a side.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had these big pieces of it. So yeah. Then we had to refresh the whole thing, and now it's served the way that we changed it to, which is pieces of boneless thigh. Marinated in buttermilk, butter and milk, but actual buttermilk, and then fried and served with mayonnaise.
I know. Very quickly, what is buttermilk? Sorry, Alice.
Soured milk.
Soured milk. You get it in a carton and like literally in the milk aisle.
It looks like almost like next to that custard that people.
Yeah.
What would you use it for other than
pancakes?
Well, in Ireland, they put it in all their soda breads.
You know that fattoush I'm making that features. Was like you can either mix yogurt into milk and it will kind of ferment, or you can just use buttermilk.
In Poland,
Henry's just coming in. He's been invited.
In Poland, they drink buttermilk.
Hi, Henry.
Hi, Henry.
Hi.
We're just giving the fried chicken to the rest of the staff, so we've got an intruder in the studio. Take the bowl.
Say hello, Henry.
Please do. In Poland, they drink buttermilk, Simon, with a meal.
Do they?
Wow.
Mm.
So over the winter, we've seen fried chicken in Auckland in a big way. There's been a festival. There's been a, what was the Melbourne restaurant that popped up?
Bell's Hot Chicken.
Bell's Hot Chicken. Texas?
Texas Chicken.
Texas Chicken claimed that they did the hottest chicken in the history of hot chicken.
Wasn't there a whole Auckland Fried Chicken Festival?
Yes.
Just said that.
Yeah. I went to that.
Sorry, I was eating the chicken.
Mad actually had a bit of reportage from the Fried Chicken Festival.
Yeah. Did you?
Yeah. There were a lot of, you can talk about it, Mad.
Yeah, so I went intending to, I took some KFC. We took KFC with us and we cut it up, some chicken strips, made it look a bit nicer, and then presented it to see if anyone noticed that it was just chicken strips rather than
some like frisée lettuce on.
Yeah, put a little bit of lettuce on it, put a toothpick in it.
Fancy lettuce.
Mm.
People did, after we said it was KFC, they were like, oh, of course. But a lot of people were just like, oh, that was pretty good. It was a bit cold because it'd been sitting in our bag. But everyone liked it,
yeah.
I think, or almost everyone. And so they didn't really notice a difference between that versus the expensive stuff that they were getting from the stalls. And then when I went up to, we wanted to line up to get, chicken, and we waited for about 40 minutes in line, and the festival was only open for a few hours, and so you can really only get one thing. And so we just sort of picked a line. You don't want to go to the longest line, even though it looks like the best, because that was like over an hour wait.
I was somehow part of this Facebook group about the Auckland Fried Chicken Festival, and it just absolutely blew up. So they started off inviting people, and then it got really hectic, and then they're like, we've got to change the venue, we've got too much interest, and then everyone's like got it in their calendars. It was an absolute frenzy.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You paid $5 to be let in.
Oh, to you still have numbers.
So they had limited numbers, but I think it was still too high because there were just so many people there. You couldn't walk because all the lines were joining together from all the different caravans.
And more importantly, you couldn't eat enough fried chicken.
And you could only, unless you went either right at the start or right at the end, if you went just in the middle, like 7 o'clock, you could pick one. If you're with someone else, I guess you could go to like one each. But yeah. then you're just standing there for like 45 minutes waiting for your one little piece of chicken.
I think it's indicative, though, of how popular fried chicken has become. I'm sorry to pin you down, Matt, just as you take a bite. But why do you think fried chicken, other than the fact it tastes so good, has reached this tipping point and has become so universally beloved? She's just chewing.
I think everyone's always liked it. People were just embarrassed to like it before.
There was some stigma around
it. There's
a bit
of a class thing.
Good point,
that,
yeah.
You know, you like, I used to think the only place you get fried chicken was KFC or the random ones that you get at the fish and chip shop that sort of just sit in that warmer.
They've cooked ages ago. Yeah, yeah.
Next to the chips. So there was a thing that if you're eating fried chicken, it means that you just got a real budget meal. And, you know, or you're eating with a whole bunch of people. And so now it's sort of like when fish and chips actually has the benefit of having its own reputation of, like, it's supposed to be in sort of budget
low-key.
But I think everyone always liked fried chicken. They just didn't want to go to the local bakery and get a piece, or they didn't want to go to KFC. And so then as soon as more upmarket places started doing essentially the exact same thing, then suddenly it's like, oh, it's fine. It's fine to like fried chicken.
I feel like it kind of comes back to what I was saying before as well. Is if it's cooked well, there almost doesn't need to be another reason. Like, it's just delicious. Everyone likes fried chicken that is cooked really well, you know? And I think that everyone's probably a bit, you know, maybe they were being judgmental about other things as well. But ultimately, if it doesn't taste good, then no one wants to eat it. Like, the ones that sit around. Before we started Bird on a Wire, we bought a fish and chip shop on Ponsonby Road that was called Nina's Takeaways. And she used to pre-fry the chicken and then just leave it sort of lingering in a bain-marie for the poor drunk person that needed a snack. Like, just make them some fresh fried chicken.
You know? I bet the drunk person still loved it.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
I'm sure I've eaten plenty of those 12-hour-old fried chicken.
You've lived to tell the tale.
Because the cultural connotations of fried chicken are really interesting. I first discovered them when I watched Dave Chappelle's Block Party. There's a black dude on the bus with a piece of watermelon and a piece of fried chicken, you know, playing, you know, don't film me, you can't show me as a cultural stereotype. Play it laughing about it. And then on David Chang's
Ugly Delicious,
documentary series on the cultural significance of food in the US, that really got into the way that fried chicken has become a stereotype of the black community. I think that same thing probably extends to New Zealand. Do you think that fried chicken has become a cultural signifier for our brown communities here and had become almost stigmatized? And I don't know, I think of your story you did with Simon that showed a really different side to the value of the importance and the place that fried chicken has for communities that have big parties with not as much money.
Big families.
I think KFC definitely is a, for me, like a Samoan or Pacific Island, it's a thing. KFC on a Sunday at about 1 o'clock is about the most busy you can get because it's when everyone's leaving church and then going to the Toonai after, which is the lunch. And you got to pick up the chicken on the way there. So that it's just every single meal that we had that involved more than 10 people. It was like a family gathering. There would always be KFC. No one mentioned it. It wasn't it was just, that is the easiest way to get a lot of meat for a lot of people at a reasonable price. And even I went to a Tuvalu community, Auckland Tuvalu community gathering. There would have been hundreds of people there. No one spoke English. It was very much a cultural gathering. And they had all the traditional foods. They had the raw fish. They had the, you know, the taro sort of like mash and all this stuff. And then just at the end, two boxes of KFC. Mm. It wasn't like that's the main thing. It was just one of about 12 different dishes that they had set up. But it's just, You just do it. They probably could have not had it there and it would have been completely
That's
fine.
That's what I liked about your article. It really speaks to the practicality of it.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, everyone likes fried chicken, but it makes absolute sense.
Mm.
Where else can you go and pick up a whole lot of hot, delicious protein for a big group of people? And who else is serving things that are easily shared?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, even Damon Salisa, who wrote about the sort of Pacific communities in Auckland and New Zealand, even he, he's sort of considered quite a scholarly person. He's very kind of, you know, quite serious and that stuff. And he said he begrudgingly admitted that he knows he's playing into a stereotype when he talks about KFC, but he also knows that if he takes KFC to a family gathering, that will be the most popular dish he ever brings to a family gathering. Mm. So it's just like, if it works, it works. But I think that reputation also then played into, oh, this is like a budget meal. Yeah. You know, this is not where people who actually appreciate food and that sort of thing go.
Yeah.
And, you know, then they play off each other. And I think that's where the only the recent rise in
Yeah, because there was a bit of a stigma. But what I thought was cool about your article too was that it was talking about the sheer number of people. Like, it's a community gathering. It's a huge family. Like, how many of us have got 13 people to feed on a Sunday?
I wonder if when KFC first opened in New Zealand, I don't think it had the stigma, because I remember my parents calling it Kentucky Fried, not KFC, and it being all, like, not fancy, but kind of cool, like.
And Simon Wright said he used to, in that article, said he used to eat it when he was small.
I think when it first opened, it was like, oh, that's very novel, sort of like, yeah, Kentucky Fried. And then I remember growing up, as I got older, it became like, you know, growing up in a white family and mainly white friends, it became like, yeah, kind of like, you'd only get it if you're hungover, kind of secretly. Mm. And it's like, you know, the dirty bird.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's very, very good, though.
It is really good. That's the thing.
I think the chips.
I mean, Simon said that he didn't like it, and that, you know, he spoke about it critically, but I still think that he couldn't get past the fact that it was fast food.
That's so interesting.
I think if you put some of that stuff, like a Wicked Wing or something, if you put that in a different context, in a different setting, and you plated it differently, I think he would have a different opinion of it.
That's interesting, and hearing you speak about the prejudice, I was sort of raised, and I often find that I'm really unprejudiced about things. I've never even thought about what you're saying. I've never thought it was shameful, never thought it was budget, never thought it was. I thought it was unhealthy, and so that's why I didn't want to eat it.
But it's kind of wound up like that, you know? I find it's kind of all bound up together, the unhealthiness and the kind of shame of it, maybe.
Sure,
for some people.
But if something's cooked, like if something's fried properly, the outside of it is permeated by the oil, not all the way through. So in my mind, it was like dripping with oil, and so I avoided it. But it's not even the case at all.
Mm. I mean, I still think if I, when I'm not at the moment, but if I am training and I'm supposed to be eating a bit better, even though KFC is the best fast food option. Because it's got fat and it's got protein, but it doesn't have the carbs and it doesn't have all that other stuff. So having just a piece of fried chicken is better than eating a probably what you'd consider like a slightly healthier burger.
What I had in the airport on my way home. I had some chicken wings and a side of salad because I didn't feel like eating carbohydrate before I got on a plane. And it was brilliant.
Yeah.
I can totally get that.
How's that for an endorsement? Marathon runner, javelin champion. You know, Madeline Chapman says, eat fried chicken. Eat KFC.
Awesome.
I think also when I was a teenager, there was a lot of stories going around about people finding, like, rats in their piece of KFC. And I think as someone who was, like, a new vegetarian, being, like, real grossed out my meat anyway, that, you know, the idea of, like, that you would find you bite into it and it was a rat really stuck with me. And it was probably bullshit, but
absolutely
that just really stuck in my head.
Razor blades in the slide.
Yeah, all those urban myths.
I feel like this is the part where I confess that I don't really get grossed out by
rats.
bad hygiene ratings. Sometimes I'm like, is it awkward that I'd still eat it?
No, I think a lot of it is misunderstood. And like, apparently, if you've got like a dog who sometimes comes in. You know, in like overseas, it's cool to have dogs in your bar and stuff. Yeah. Here, like there's a vineyard on Waiheke where a dog hangs out of the vineyard, which is charming. Yeah. It's like a D rating because they have a dog that goes around there sometimes.
What rating do you think your kitchen would get, Matt?
At home?
Yeah.
At our flat? It depends. It goes
any
through,
given day.
It goes through waves of like sometimes I'll go in and spend like 5 hours cleaning the oven, and then, but then you just watch it slowly. Like,
then you leave it for 5 years
yeah,
and do
then
it
you
again.
Just watch it slowly get worse. But I think overall, probably a B.
Sophie?
Solid.
You have an obsessive compulsive cleaning husband.
No, but I think I'm a solid B as well. Like, are you talking about food hygiene? Like, we're reheating rice. I'm an absolute rogue in terms of what food safety is supposed to be.
I'd say at home, at my childhood home, though, it would have got an A+.
Yeah.
I thought everyone had ovens that were, like, spotless all the time. No,
oh, really?
That's just our
nah,
oven.
Mate.
Yeah. Alice?
Yeah, well, I don't want to copy, but I was thinking a solid B. Like, I live by myself, so I don't, you know, there's no really excuse for my kitchen getting filthy.
What you would eat is different to what you're allowed to serve and what you would serve as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, well, I mean, after yesterday with the cake incident, now I've got an oven filled with cake batter, but other than that.
I'm an advocate of leaving a rotisserie chicken on the bench all day, oh, and yeah. even overnight, and eating it. Just don't refrigerate it because it loses the flavour, but you could never do that.
I think it's the oven that always lets you down as well. It's such a painful clean.
Oh, yeah. I'm traumatised from about the 2 times in my life I've cleaned an oven. Then I've just paid people to do it.
Oh, okay.
Which is worth it. It's like, get it on Grab One. It's like $50.
What? And they do like
someone,
the whole...
Just an oven cleaner. Or like a cleaner.
So a cleaner, someone who comes in and does it.
Wow.
But just ovens?
Well, I can't remember.
I would pay a
I'd
lot.
Pay,
I feel
yeah.
like
I
you've
got
to be an expert
like,
to, like, paying just a regular cleaner
no,
to
I think
clean
it's like
an oven.
Oven cleaner,
like,
a specialist oven cleaner.
Gotta,
yeah.
Have you seen those fancy ovens that have self-cleaning on them?
We
does
got
that actually
one of
work, though?
When,
yeah.
After 20 years of renovations, my mum finally got a new kitchen, and the one thing she wanted was a double oven that self-cleaned.
Oh, good on her.
Does it work?
Turns out, it, like, sort of. It goes just so hot that it's supposed to, like, fry everything on it. And then all you got to do is just go
like,
in and,
wipe
like,
it
just
out.
Wipe. But even she was like, eh.
Yeah, but she's got A+ standards.
Yeah,
I think
it.
I'd be sweet with it.
Yeah, I think if you were just wanting to maintain it, whatever, it would work, yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to, like, incinerate the whole insides of your oven, and then you just wipe it.
Wipe
and walk away.
So what rating is your kitchen getting, Simon?
Other than the oven, like a B, I'm blessed to have someone who makes me clean. She has high standards and makes me maintain them. Food hygiene-wise, I think I'm improving.
Mm.
We're having the monthly shared spin-off feed today, and I had these organic lamb shanks that were 2 weeks past their best before.
Yeah,
I contacted my butcher and I said, look, the vacuum pack is still really tight. Mm-hmm. They haven't turned green. She was very reluctant about me serving them. And she said, okay, open them up and see what they smell like in half an hour, because you have that vacuum pack. They smell strange when you first open them. After half an hour, they don't smell very good at all. So you can be very comfortable knowing that I made the right decision and they went in the rubbish bin rather than into the oven.
But it is heartbreaking. I know. I hate it.
It's my own fault as well. It really annoys me.
I think that the use by best before thing is one of the biggest scams in food. Like, you really need to know, and people should know, how to smell and touch and even taste it to see whether the food's okay. Like, use by, it's literally them just saying, I want you to buy more of my product, so I'm just going to put a short life on it.
There's a bottle of sour cream in the fridge here at work that is unopened, that's about a month past its best before, but it's sour cream. Like, I'm sure if we open it and it's not moldy, it'll be fine, right?
Worst case scenario, it's soured.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's serve it at lunch. Mad, I know you have things to do. You're welcome to stay and talk about American beverages, or you can go and continue to do what you're paid for.
Aside from Dr. Pepper, I don't have any knowledge of American beverages.
Well, this is where you're about to get it. So if you have to leave, listen to the food podcast. If you want to stay, you're going to learn about Californian Chardonnay.
Stick around, Ned.
I actually have to go and make a meme.
That's
So that it's just tackling the world's big problem.
You're forgiven. So we know a lot about American food. It's very much a part of our popular culture, but I feel like we know less about American beverages. So today we've been drinking a Batch Brewing Billfish American Pale Ale. Alice, what's an American Pale Ale?
Well, Simon, it's a very complex and sort of murky category beer, but it's probably a good place to start by saying that the modern craft beer scene, pretty much we have a lot to thank America for. You know, the fact that we're drinking delicious hoppy craft beers in New Zealand kind of all came from America. The APA, so this is it. What we're drinking is actually a New Zealand beer. It's from Batch Brewing and it's called the Billfish APA. They don't actually call it an American pale ale, but that's where what originally an APA was, an American pale ale, and they thought they, from my extensive Google-based research, an American pale ale probably, they think, came about in about 1980. It's basically just a pale ale that uses American hops. And it has now become a sort of catch-all phrase to mean a pale ale that's quite hoppy, but there's a lot of crossover, but generally not as high alcohol or as hoppy as an IPA.
That's really useful information for me because I don't really like IPAs because they are too hoppy for me. But however, this one is absolutely delicious.
I will qualify that in saying it's basically whatever the brewer wants. So people can call something an APA and it can be like hoppy as fuck, like 8%. And they can call it an IPA and it can be not. So it's not just go with caution. This APA features, I think basically Batch Brewing has called it an APA because it has, yes, American hops, but also Aotearoa and Australian hops.
Okay.
So, like, and Tuatara does an APA that they call the Aotearoa Pale Ale. So,
yeah, I mean, do you think they don't want to call it American because, for example, Batch Brewing's branding is very Kiwiana?
But maybe, but also, yeah, it's just kind of not. I mean, yeah, it's generally APAs are around like 5.86%.
Mm-hmm.
Hoppy, yum, but not like the crazily hoppy, really strong IPA.
The very famous Dump the Trump beer. Was that an APA?
I think so. I mean, but it could have been an IPA. You know, it's just whatever.
Tell me about the Dump the Trump beer.
Oh, see, they call that an IPA. Dump the Trump is from Behemoth Brewing Company.
It's an anti-Donald Trump beer.
It's an anti-Donald Trump beer.
It's what we've all been drinking. Yeah.
You'd match it. We're looking at the website now. You match it with orange Cheetos.
So, yeah.
Oh, gross.
Behemoth is a guy called Andrew Childs, who is he's based in Auckland now. He's from Wellington originally. And his wife is the Lady Butcher, who's American. Do you know her? She's a butcher, and her company's called A Lady Butcher.
Cool.
Anyway, they first brewed it before Trump was elected, thinking, like, he's not going to get elected.
Yeah, like everyone thought.
And, yeah, so that's an American IPA. And then he got elected. And then, so now they rebrewed it earlier this year and released it.
Did you say American IPA?
Yeah.
Now that is confusing.
Well, that's the thing. With beer styles, there's no set rules. You can call whatever.
Just go wild.
Whatever, yeah. I mean, if something's called, like, no one could claim that they know the difference between an IPA and an APA because there's not. And they can, you know, it's just whatever the brewer wants to call it, basically.
Okay.
But, yeah, so this is called an APA. And it's actually really nice. It's quite light, very drinkable, not overly hoppy. Tastes like summer to me.
I think that's why I like it.
Yeah.
Summer's almost here as well. It's a beautiful day.
I know.
Still quite cold.
Yeah. But, like, another one is the Panhead Supercharger, that's an APA. So, yeah, they're among my favourite beers.
Is that similar to this
one? I'd say it's hoppier. Like this one, and this one's quite golden coloured.
Yeah.
And quite light.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the Supercharger is one of my faves. I Yeah, it might be you might find it a bit.
You're much more of an aficionado than me, though. I think you go deeper on the hops.
I like hops, and I can tell. I know that some people don't, and also that they become addictive. Like the more hoppy beers you drink, the more you want.
Yeah, so that's why I'm still at rookie status.
But you don't. Yeah, I like feel like I've almost become a junkie for hops. You don't want to be that person.
So as well as the beer, we have delivered to us this morning from Fine Wine Delivery Company, a Californian Chardonnay by Pacificana. It's 2017 and it's been, the cork is causing me problems.
It's nice to have a cork. Fermented. It's quite rare these days, isn't it?
This is doing wonders for the birthday hangover, everyone. Oh, thank you.
So barrel fermented, did you say?
It's quite light. Oh, no, put to the sky, it's
it's light compared to the sort of classic American Chardonnays.
The buttery numbers.
Yeah, that got the reputation for being strong and oaky.
Yeah.
Just, you know, that was a style that was a bit more aggressive than what they're going for here.
I think we often forget about the US as a wine producing company in country in New Zealand. You know, I automatically gravitate to New Zealand wine, and then after that I think about France, think about Spain, and of course Australia as well, but I can't remember the last time I bought a bottle of US wine. And when I drove from LA to San Francisco, there are vines everywhere, and it's very famous, and I just don't think about it.
These guys are particularly, they're in the exact zone that you're speaking about. But I think that there is a bit of a new wave of Californian winemaking that is a reaction to what was there before. So like we were just saying, those super aggressive, really oaky Chardonnays and the reds that were really berryish and full of fruit. And now they're going, that was a bit much, let's pull back and or just refresh it and refine it. So this Chardonnay actually tastes how I was expecting it to. I think it's more akin to Hawke's Bay Chardonnay for us. So it's got a creaminess to it that is just as present as the oak. It's not like a big smash in the face of oak when you drink it.
I'm enjoying it because I'm not a huge fan of the really oaky, buttery chards. It's a bit sweet, but maybe that's just following the beer. And I like the label, so it's got a beer on it, which is nice.
It's got a really nice, I think it would be absolutely delicious with food. It's substantial enough that you wouldn't be drinking it without food after more than one glass probably. But I think that it would be amazing with seafood, with pasta.
Have either of you watched the documentary on Netflix called Somme?
Yes.
No.
It's about a group of friends who are absolutely hectic about wine and their journey to trying to pass the exam to become a master sommelier. The way they analyze the wine from tip to toe is absolutely crazy, and the speed at which they do it, doing the color and the flavors, and you know, they at one point they found hints of rotting animal carcass in a red wine, you know, burnt orange skins. It's crazy what you, the flavor profiles that they can pull out of this grape juice.
Yeah, and Alice was just saying that she's a bit of a hop junkie. I think I'm heading towards the wine version of that. The more you drink, the more you think about it, the more you taste, the more you read about it, the more you want to. And so that's the extreme, the Somme documentary. It is amazing. It's how to make wine into an absolutely academic.
It's quite alarming.
Yeah, it is. It's super hardcore and it's extremely serious.
Yeah.
And obviously that's not what we're aiming for. But in that documentary, they are swirling and smelling the wine. And they say things like, the wine is white, the wine is French, the wine is from 1985 to 19. Yeah. You know, it's extremely specific how they can drill it down.
See, I much prefer to anthropomorphize my wine. Okay. To give it some human characteristics.
You're like, okay, what do you mean by that?
I think, you know, this wine is quite a long-legged blonde on a early summer's day who is out for a long lunch with only female friends, and she's smart.
Sounds like me, to be honest.
I feel like it's Prosecco that he's talking about.
Yeah.
No, this is more sophisticated than Prosecco.
Is she basic or a bit more?
No, she reads books.
Yeah.
She might have a subscription to The New Yorker.
Okay.
You know that.
She's a deep thinker.
Mm.
Well, anyway, she's got good taste in wine.
Yeah, no, she would order snapper to go with this, but she doesn't mind a bit of fried chicken on the way home later that night.
Yeah.
After a few espresso martinis.
Would she want to know if the snapper was line caught, or is she not that woke?
She's woke as.
Yeah.
This is woke wine.
Mm. Do you think the barrel fermentedness, are you guys getting a slight funk? Very slight? Or am I just getting that from reading barrel fermented?
Like someone, yes, I get that. She,
I'm not getting funk.
She has clean feet, but she goes running, so there's just like a slight funk.
That's not me anymore, because I do not go running.
Yeah, you're like, my feet might smell, but I don't run.
Not from running. Actually, my feet don't smell. I've never, like, people don't believe me, but I've never had smelly feet. No matter how sweaty I get, can wear no socks with shoes.
Maybe you don't have sweat glands in your feet.
Maybe.
But this woman does.
This woman does. Good to know.
I think it's absolutely delicious. Yeah. And I also think that it's less than $20, which is quite important because no one can be drinking wine that costs more than $20 if they're not loaded.
Yeah, totally.
You know? So like a really nice quality wine. It kind of, to me, it tastes really like elegant. And it's affordable and delicious. So I'm into it.
Yeah, I'm into it.
I'm into it as well. Really interesting journey through the US today. I think it does suffer from a stigma at times, and it has amazing things to offer from a food and beverage perspective. We'd better go. I have to cook a huge feed for 25 people over two camping stoves this afternoon for the spin-off's shared Friday feed, a monthly celebration. Really nice to have you home, Sophie. Happy birthday. We've got a beautiful chocolate cake cooked by Alice.
Thanks
to
so
celebrate.
Much.
It's a devil's food cake, which is an American cake.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit about that just before we
Well, start? Basically, it's just a chocolate cake, and they called it a devil's food cake as a response to something called an angel food cake.
Oh, right.
But it's basically just quite an intense chocolate cake. This recipe is Nigella, who's not American, but I don't like using American recipes because they all say, like, one stick of butter. And like, who the fuck knows how much that is?
Yeah.
And we love Nigella as well.
We do, yes.
Do you know Nigella was named after her dad, whose name's it's Nigel?
I did know that.
Oh, really? I always thought it was a Nigella seed.
No,
she's obscure food reference.
She's a junior.
So you can call your firstborn daughter.
I don't think the chat can get much better than that.
Well, subscribe to Dietary Requirements on iTunes. Tell your friends about it. Read our recipes. Go look out for Sophie's diary from Ballymaloo. Is that correct pronunciation?
It is, yes.
On thespinoff.co.nz, and join us next month.
Thanks, everyone.
Ka kite.
Enjoy your feast.
Falafel Lover, I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spin-Off. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spin-Off member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate. The Spin-Off Podcast Network.